Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to the Quota Cutta podcast. So this week we have a huge treat for you guys with the Dogen coming on the show. But first, I want to make a quick announcement to everyone listening on Spotify and Apple Podcasts that if you haven't heard already, we are now doing video podcasts on YouTube. So if you're interested in seeing Dogen or maybe even our faces, be sure to check it out. Also, make sure to subscribe to our YouTube channel as we've noticed a large percentage of our listeners have not yet done it. And it really helps support the podcast a long way and means a lot to us, especially as we make the push to 1,000 subscribers. But going back to this episode, we had a really fun conversation with Dogen highlighting how he actually got into learning Japanese in the first place, some of his unique experiences regarding Japan, and the behind the scenes of how the Dogen videos are made. That was a really interesting point for me specifically, but you get some advice in there and more. So we have a really exciting show in store for you guys, so I hope you enjoy. Hey, what's up, guys? Welcome back to the Quota Cutta podcast. My name is Raza, and I'm joined by my co-host, Eric. We talk to people of all types of backgrounds about their lives in Japan, studying Japanese, or even tips and tricks on how to learn the language. This week, we are joined by a very special guest in Dogen.
Yes, so I don't think he really needs much of an intro. You guys all know who he is, but I guess in the off chance that you're a Quota Cutta podcast fan and you don't know who Dogen is, he's a YouTuber who makes comedic videos purely in Japanese, and he has a very popular course on Patreon where he teaches Japanese pitch accent. So you know his Japanese is legit or jozu. So anyways, Dogen, can you give us a quick background of who you are and where you're at today?
Yeah, sure. So I am a weeb at heart. So like most people, I kind of grew up just kind of interested in Japan all around, whether it was anime, Japanese music, Japanese movies, manga, some Japanese books. But my main thing was martial arts, actually. And so I was really interested in like karate and, well, various forms of martial arts, whether it was Aikido and that kind of thing. And that kind of bloomed into those other things that I just mentioned. And as I got older, I decided that I wanted to start studying Japanese. So I studied Japanese kind of, I bought some old used cassette tapes from a used bookstore, as well as like a Japanese grammar book. And I started teaching myself Japanese when I was about, I want to say 13 years old. And then I kind of started doing that on and off for, well, basically until my first year of high school. And then from there, I got really into the martial arts kind of thing. And I kind of just continued to listen to Japanese music and like some TV shows and stuff. But my main passion at that time was what's called martial arts tricking. And I that was my main passion basically all throughout high school and the first half of college. But during my second half of college, I got really, really back into the Japanese side of things because I started to realize I wasn't going to be able to make a career out of martial arts tricking. And so I started to think about what I wanted to do, what I wanted to major in, what I wanted to study, that kind of thing. And during my study abroad year in Japan, I studied abroad for 1 year at Keio University during my third year of university. I met the main singer of one of the Japanese bands that I listened to when I was like 13 or 14. And that was kind of like a life-changing experience for me. I had this conversation about her, like, why did you want to become like an artist? Because she had such a big influence on me. Like, one of the reasons I started studying Japanese is because of the music that her band created. And basically, what I took away from that conversation is that you can use art to inspire people, hopefully. And at that time, I didn't know if there was any form of art or artistic medium, you know, that I could pursue as an option. But before meeting the band, I wrote them this really long letter in Japanese that was like, you inspired me to study Japanese. I'm currently living in Tokyo and having like the time of my life. And I just wanted to say, you know, thank you. And they reached out to me and said, hey, come to our next concert. We're a small band. We can definitely meet up and, you know, talk. And so we ended up having that conversation. And basically, at the end of that conversation, she said, well, yeah, like that letter that you wrote really meant so much to me. And I did put a lot of like time and effort into writing that. And I had like a blog at the time. And I thought to myself, maybe, just maybe, I could try writing. And so I went back to the States after my year of study abroad. And I continued to major in Japanese. But at the same time, I started studying creative writing as a subject at university. So I took like three or four classes on, you know, advanced creative writing, that kind of thing. And the feedback that I always got was the feedback that I never anticipated on getting, which is that, okay, you're trying too hard when you write seriously, but when you write comedy, when you write these like jokes, this is actually kind of funny. So if you want to be a writer, you might want to try and pursue comedy. I had like two professors tell me that. And then after graduating from university and starting to try and write in Japanese, I had a friend from Tokyo University. He was from the literature department. And he said to me the same exact thing. He said, this short story that you wrote in Japanese, you're trying way too hard. But like this short essay that you wrote about like these weird people in Starbucks, this is pretty funny. And so from that point forward, I basically just tried to more or less pursue the, well, what would you say, comedy through creative writing. And I kind of self-published a few books. I made a little bit of money off of it. And I thought that I was okay at it, not like a great writer or anything, but decent. And one day I had the idea of, okay, well, maybe I could make more money and grow like a larger audience if rather than doing this in text medium, rather than just writing these books, what if I just delivered these essays and little, you know, stories that I wrote on YouTube? Would they do better? And I've been doing that for 5 years at this point.
And also like earlier you were saying how another impact was martial arts. And mm-hmm. that was one of your first big inspirations. So how did you actually get into martial arts to begin with? Were you competing or just watching martial arts?
Yeah, so I was from a pretty, what would you say, typical, I hesitate to use the term white, but, you know, like pretty typical suburban Caucasian white family. And I did kind of, you know, like soccer, baseball, basketball, that kind of thing. And that was completely, you know, normal for me. That's like what I grew up doing. And that was, you know, great. I had a great, great life. But there was something about like martial arts that was so different from like the typical ball sports, so to speak. And that was a big draw to me. And I was like, whoa, this is like so cool. It's like a little bit more refined, it seemed to me at the time, at least. And So I was just always really, really kind of interested in that. But one of the things that really kind of, what would you say, ignited the fire, so to speak, was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. You remember that movie?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So I saw that movie in the movie theater, and it blew me away. Like I don't know if you remember the opening fight scene in that movie, but there's kind of like this chase scene through the castle, and it ends up with like this fight, and there's like some wire choreography and stuff like that with like this traditional kind of Chinese music. And again, I walked out of the movie theater thinking like, I have to learn how to do this. Like, oh my God. It was kind of the first time in my life when I felt like truly, truly inspired by something or truly drawn to something really, really strongly. And so basically I just started trying to do like cartwheels and like that kind of thing, like in my backyard. And I happened to find this website called Trick Busters, but I think they were hosting it on like Geospace or something. And it was basically just all these kind of like short tutorials for kind of acrobatic martial arts moves. So like flash kicks, butterfly kicks, 540 kicks, that kind of thing. And that was more interesting to me than just kind of like the raw martial arts in terms of like the stances and like using martial arts as a like self-defense tool and that kind of thing. So I was more kind of actually into the martial arts acrobatics. And I just tried using the internet, like most people that were into tricking back in the day, I kind of just self-taught myself over the course of like 6 or 7 years, getting a lot of really bad injuries along the way. And again, that was my main passion until I kind of had the realization that I wasn't good enough at it to monetize it about halfway through college. So.
Was there any draw towards like Chinese martial arts, or was it mostly Japanese?
Yeah, well, yeah, it initially started with Chinese martial arts and like the Shaolin monks. And again, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is a Chinese movie. But I think at the time when I was 12, 13, 14, I didn't properly understand the differences in like Chinese and Japanese culture. And it started out with kind of just martial arts. And in learning more about martial arts, I kind of, through happenstance, also started learning more about Asian culture. And that's kind of how I found, like, started to find, like, Japanese music and that kind of thing.
And I mean, it's really interesting that you were able to kind of get this entire passion just from that initial interest of martial arts and kind of coming along the way towards Japanese. And speaking to Japanese, I mean, you did spend time studying Japanese in college as well, right?
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely true. Yeah. So my first year in college, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I started studying business because one of my senpai, the older guy at the fraternity that I lived in, he was like, well, you know, business is a safe choice. I started studying business. I hated it. So I was like, I got to find one subject that I actually like to study. And at that point, I had never studied Japanese in the classroom. It was all self-study. So I took a Japanese class at university, and I was like, yep, this is it. This is what I like to do. And I changed my major from business to Japanese. So I wasted about a year's worth of business studies, you know, microeconomics, macroeconomics, and accounting. I learned those, and then I forgot it all.
Oh, business coming back a little bit now, right?
Yeah, actually. It's really, really interesting how those things that you would never expect to, what would you say, apply later on. Oftentimes, those are like the things that make like the biggest difference.
Yeah. And I mean, on the podcast, one of the great debates we always come across is the whole idea between classroom learning and immersion. And I mean, as you've spent so much time in Japan, being able to immerse into the culture, the country, as well as actually also taking those college courses, what would you say is your kind of take on this debate?
It's difficult to say because it, in my opinion, it depends completely on the individual Japanese learner. And what I mean by that is that there's a lot of people, myself included, and people like Matt from Matt versus Japan, who I think you guys had on the podcast as well. And I don't know if you happen to see the guy Nick that I shared on Twitter not too long ago. Incredible Japanese speaker. Way better than me, definitely. But there's certain people like that who I think we all fall into this category that I'm about to describe, which is kind of people that are really, really motivated and don't really necessarily need a regime forced upon them in order to study. And if you fall into that category and you've got enough motivation to do it by yourself, I think that for sure the immersion-based approach, all Japanese all the time, refold Matt versus Japan method is the way to go, for sure. At the same time, I think that there's a lot of people that don't have maybe quite enough motivation or self-control to stick to a regime that they sort of have to make by themselves to a certain degree. I know that Matt lays out those tools very, very well. But there's certainly something to be said about going to a Japanese classroom and having a Japanese teacher kind of pull you along, so to speak. And I think that, again, there's merits to both setting, but I think for the long run, for the people that have motivation and want to get to a level that's as high as possible, certainly the immersion-based approach is, in my opinion, more effective.
I see. And I guess now speaking to your own Japanese, I guess on the channel you've mentioned many times about the classic, the Jozu moments, you know, and kind of making fun of them a lot. But how long did it take you to kind of, I guess, graduate from the Jozu moments?
Oh, geez. Well, I think that everyone still gets the Jozu moments occasionally, because like if you go into like a konbini and you say like, you know, I don't know, kore wo kudasai or whatever. You know, even if you just say like one word or like ohayou gozaimasu, konnichiwa, arigatou gozaimasu, you're still going to get that from some people. So I still get that, you know, occasionally. But I think the first kind of real moment that I had where it was like, oh, I kind of actually speak Japanese. I talked about this not too long ago in one of my streams on Twitch, but in study abroad during that year in Tokyo, actually, the first half, I kind of kept my head down and studied pretty hard. And then during spring break, which is long for Japanese universities, I think it was like a month long, I took a 1 week break and I went to visit that same cousin that I mentioned earlier. He was living in Kobe at the time as an English teacher. So I took a break from university and I went to go see him, and we hung out for like, again, a week, and we just kind of chilled and, you know, listened to Hamasaki Ayumi and, you know, kind of natsukashi hanashi o takusan shimashita. But anyway, what right. happened is up until that point, I kind of didn't know whether or not I could tell people I speak Japanese, because I was still kind of working my way through basic and intermediate grammar, albeit at a fairly rapid pace. At university, at Keio University, in the classroom. But I felt like there was still a lot that I couldn't understand in everyday conversation. But for whatever reason, I don't know if it was because, almost because of gyakuni, when I went to see my cousin, we didn't use any Japanese, so maybe it gave my brain like a week to rest or whatever. But when that week was over and I went back to Tokyo, I remember riding the train on the way back to Tokyo and vividly remember thinking, wait a second, I can like understand like everything that everyone around me is saying. Like it didn't feel like this like a week ago. So suddenly it was like all the stars kind of aligned. And when I got back to Tokyo, I felt like I can speak Japanese, or like I can at least understand Japanese. And the first day back at school, after spring break, I remember sitting in the courtyard. I was just kind of like chilling, having like a kankohi in the nakaniwa, the courtyard of the university. And this Japanese student next to me started talking to me. He was like, hey, how's it going? Like, where are you from? And we had like a 5 or 10 minute conversation. And he didn't say Nihongo Jozu to me once. So I was like, okay.
This is the moment where Dogen was born.
You know, it's funny because you mentioned, you know, Dogen specifically, but kind of, again, it's funny how things like kind of all come together. But the reason, you guys might know this, but the reason that I use the name Dogen rather than my real name is because back in the day when I was doing that martial arts tricking, there was a right. forum online called Tricks Tutorials. And on that forum, all the tricksters would go there and share tricking clips and that kind of thing. And my normal name was taken. And so I used the name of the Zen Buddhist priest that I was learning about in the books about Zen Buddhism that I was reading for fun at the time outside of school. And that priest's name is Dolgen. So that's where Dolgen comes from. Again, kind of from tricking. And I've just kind of used it for everything online since. Like you saw, like my Gmail account, like that's from back in high school or whatever. So sometimes people ask me, like, you know, like, why do you use Dolgen? Why don't you use like your normal name, or, you know, what's the origin of Dolgen, that kind of thing? And that's kind of that whole backstory.
Imagine if you went the Zen Buddhism route instead.
It's interesting. But, it's interesting to think about what might have been, so to speak.
Yeah. And I guess at this point, you've been in Japan for a good amount of time, kind of to the point where you've really kind of assimilated and you kind of know what to expect a lot of the times when, I mean, basically living there. But how would you say kind of Japan has changed since the time you first arrived as a study abroad student to now?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. I think there's probably maybe three things that I'd like to mention. The first is that although it was already kind of on the decline, so to speak, not on the decline, but when I initially came to Japan as a study abroad student, I think that relatively speaking, it was still somewhat rare to be a foreigner in Japan. The first time I came to Japan was in 2007.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And obviously, I mean, like compared to a time like maybe like the 80s or like, you know, if you want to go way back, say like the Meiji era or something like that, it was obviously much
Can you even
more...
study abroad?
Well, I think there were some people back in the day. But anyway, the novelty of being a foreigner when I was, again, 2007, 2008, there was still somewhat of a novelty, so to speak. And there still is to a certain degree. Mm. But I was under the impression before study abroad that I was going to be the only foreigner that most Japanese people had ever talked to or seen. And not only was that not the case at all, I was usually like the 50 or 60th foreigner. But I think that even more so, that's like in recent years, that's even, what would you say, the novelty has worn off even more. So I think that if you plan on going to Japan kind of, and you're secretly hoping that you'll be popular just because you're a foreigner, which I think a lot of people think that way, including myself, like my past self. You know, it's good to know that. It's not good to know. You should know that not only is that not the case, but 9 times out of 10, Japanese people can pick up on the fact that you are like, hey, look how special I am because I'm a foreigner. And that's irritating. So just be like a normal person. You know, that's the best thing to do in Japan as a foreigner, I think. So I think the novelty factor, the rareness of being a foreigner in Japan is wearing off for sure. And point number two is, I think that, and you guys probably have experienced this as well, but the amount of loan words, English, well, Western loan words that are being used in everyday Japanese has increased significantly since I started studying Japanese. So one of the movies that I talk about constantly on my Patreon series is Juninin no Yasashi Nihonjin. It's called The Gentle 12 in English. And I think it was made in like 1990 or something like that. But the Japanese used in that movie, there's very, very little. I always recommend that movie because it's a courtroom drama. And if you use that movie for listening, it's nonstop dialogue from start to finish. And it's got female and male speakers and younger speakers, older speakers. It's really good for listening. But the Japanese in that movie, besides for like the opening scene where they're taking their drink orders and saying like, kohi, meron soda, banana juice. Besides that like opening scene, there is very, very little, there are very little loan words, English loan words in that movie. So if you like watch that movie to study Japanese, but then maybe watch like a mainstream Japanese YouTuber instead, the amount of loanwords is the difference in the amount of loanwords that are being used is immediately noticeable for anyone that's above an intermediate level, I think. And that's always, again, I don't want to say whether one, what would you say, traditional Japanese or modern Japanese is better. That's not my call to make, but the difference is certainly there. And then I think the final thing is that people, this could just be because I'm a self-employed individual that pays taxes in Japan. So the main issue could just be that I'm now much more aware of it. But a lot of the issues that I heard about growing up, like in my social studies class, like Japan has a declining population. Japan's economy is going to be in trouble in, you know, down the road. I'm starting to see that. And one of the examples of that for example, is that I want to say when I studied abroad in Japan, the sales tax for everything, I think it was at either 3% or 5%. And since then, it's gone from, if it was at 3, then it went to 5, and then it went from 5 to 8. And then I think 2 years ago, at this point, it went from 8 to 10.
Wow.
So it's increasing very, very rapidly. And at the same time, the Japanese government is continuing to announce a fair number of policies in which, like, it's evident that the aging population is starting to become an unignorable issue. So like one of the issues is like up until fairly recently, you could get your nenkin, your social security that you paid into, I think at like 60 or 65 or something like that. And they're introducing all these policies. And I think there might be a policy similar to this in the States as well. But you can't actually get it until you're like 67. Or like if you opt not to take it until like you're 70, you can get a little bit more. But of course, if you die before that happens, you know, then there's what's the point, so to speak. But there's a lot of government policies and just a lot of little things. Like if you live in a place like where I live, Beppu, which is kind of the countryside Japan, I want to say like 7 out of every 10 people that you see are old people, elderly people. It's not really the same in Tokyo because all the young people want to go to Tokyo and move to Tokyo. So you see a lot of younger people in Tokyo. But I think besides the big cities, Fukuoka, Nagoya, Osaka, Sendai, Tokyo, maybe Sapporo, really, you can like actually visibly see the aging population when you go out and like go out for like a meal or something like that.
I see.
Yeah.
I guess like now, like transitioning kind of to like your YouTube and Patreon work. Mm-hmm. And I kind of want to ask like what goes into making a Dogen video. But before that, it seems like you spend a lot of time like optimizing your schedule and also your workflow. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like maybe with like your daily routine or something like that?
Yeah, sure. Our daily routine. Well, to be honest, my daily routine up until about a month and a half ago, up until when my girl started going to school, was complete chaos because I was a stay-at-home dad. So it was literally just like work when my girls are taking their afternoon nap or any other, you know, 5 minutes that I can grab here or there. But now that they've started going to school, it's much more, I can actually like, I have enough time to think about my time and how to like properly use it. But one of the things that I did, and we talked about this a little bit before the podcast, is that once I started making even a little bit of money on Patreon and YouTube, I immediately started investing that back into my business. And the main reason for that is because I had so much little time to begin with that something like waiting for a video to render, which is depending on the size of the video, you know, either a 2 minute, a 5 minute, a 10 minute, or like a 20 minute process. You know, it can be shorter, it can be longer, but that was a big deal for me. So I started buying all sorts of equipment that would get rid of that. So one good example is like a capture card. So I used to, you know, take the SD card that I used in my camera right here, and I would take that out of my camera and plug it into my computer, and it would transfer the ProRes files that were 50 to 100 gigabytes to my desktop. And that would take 15 minutes every single video. But when I bought a capture card, it allowed me to just capture the video directly to the desktop. So it took out that step completely. And like recently, I'm actually using this thing called a Ultra Studio 4K Extreme. It's like this really, really high-end professional capture card that Blackmagic Japan lent out to me. But it allows me to capture in H.265. So like this really, really compressed but high-quality video codec. So like when I send a video to my editor who helps me with my Patreon lessons, excuse me, it only takes like 2 minutes to upload the video as opposed to like 2 hours, which it used to take with like, again, those 100 gigabyte files. So I do think that it's a good idea to invest in your business, though it's also worth saying that I think guys in particular, we tend to confuse toys with business investments. So you got to kind of draw the line. You got to be careful about what you buy.
Yeah, right. Definitely. Mm-hmm. And I guess like, so with making like a Dogen video, like how mm-hmm. does it take, is it really optimized now that you have an editor? And I think you also showed your business partner recently.
Yeah. So the basic process right now, excuse me, is I prefer to work on the comedic content. And so the editing itself for the Patreon lessons, not the scripting, but the editing, my partner, JP, he'll take care of essentially that whole process. And when it comes to the comedic videos, I'll typically send him the raw footage. And if I say the same line like 5 times in a row, like if I say, 今から日本語の講座を行います, or whatever it is, there's like a 2 second or 3 second blank space in between that. There's like bathroom breaks during shooting and that kind of thing. So I'll send him the raw footage. He'll take out all those empty spaces. He'll send it back to me. And then from that, I choose the take that I like the best. Then I put on the subtitles, and then that's kind of the basic workflow. But the main thing for my content has always been the script. And that's, yeah, obviously something that I do by myself, so.
I see. And I guess speaking to that script then, what kind of goes into making a Dogen script? Because, I mean, we've talked earlier about kind of writing and how you kind of went towards the comedic route. And mm-hmm. you spent a lot of time at this point kind of really honing that skill. Mm-hmm. Is it really, I guess, easy? Is it quick to come up with these ideas? Like, do you have a list of every annoying or random experience that happened to you in Japan ready to go?
Yeah, kind of. So oftentimes the ideas themselves will just kind of like come to me, those like pop into my mind randomly.
Right.
And because I've kind of exhausted a lot of ideas at this point, I don't have a script. I don't have a list anymore. I just have the single individual next video that I'm going to be working on that'll kind of often just pop into my mind like 2 or 3 days before I actually start, before the deadline. But I think I talked about this to Matt a little bit, but I think maybe some people confuse they think that my Japanese is better than it is because in my opinion, my creative writing skills are actually better than my Japanese. And because of that, like, if you can get someone to laugh, you can typically get someone to have an agreeable impression of you. And that'll affect everything about their impression of you. So if I speak with pretty good Japanese, but then I can make someone laugh, while doing that in Japanese, then it's kind of like, oh, I haven't, there hasn't been a lot of instances in which I watched a foreigner speak Japanese and they got me to laugh. This is kind of, you know, fun. This is interesting. So I certainly think people like Matt from Matt versus Japan and like Nick, like definitely their Japanese is better than mine. But because I kind of do this different thing, because I do the creative writing, there's just kind of like a different ingredient that goes into my content, so to speak. And maybe that's what helps things. But in terms of like actually writing out a script, I think the main thing for me, and you guys can probably get this after having a conversation with me, but I'm not a very articulate person. And that's because I tend to overthink things. And that actually helps a lot when scripting or with creative writing in general, because in my opinion, in this day and age, people have the tendency to immediately post every kind of, what would you say, thought that comes into their head that they think is funny. And 9 times out of 10, in my opinion, if that same person took an additional 15 minutes to write that funny thought down on a piece of paper, to look at it, to look at every single word in the thought, after articulating the thought into words, and thought, is this the best word for every word in the sentence? Is this the best choice for every word in the sentence? Could I rearrange the words in this sentence to make the impact of this idea more powerful? So oftentimes it's less the idea and more about how to communicate the idea. And that's where I think the creative background writing for me, all those years of, well, initially, again, starting as just a blogger, but writing, thinking about, is this like an interesting way to say this? And then in university, learning more about like the creative writing processes, or the process and kind of like small tricks that you can use, and like the callback and stuff like that. And then just 3 or 4 years of creative writing with like those various essays before doing anything on YouTube, that skill, in my opinion, is what allows me to now have kind of like an idea that every other person living in Japan has thought about, but maybe articulate that in a way that's hopefully interesting to some people. I think it's a matter of patience. I think if you just have the patience to think about the idea and, again, how to articulate that in the best way possible, I think a lot more people could do what I'm doing.
The Dogen tricks, I guess, going from tricking to tips and tricks now. And I mean, speaking of tips and tricks, one thing I kind of personally miss are the Dogen tech reviews. Are we ever going to see the return of those?
Maybe. You might have heard this if you've seen that video, but one of the reasons that I actually, the first video that I ever did on YouTube was that kind of fake tech review of that phone, is because I thought that that would have a larger audience than starting with just, you know, jokes in Japanese. So right. I purposely started with kind of like a broader thing, like a fake tech review. And then I went from there to talking about Japanese movie names, but doing that in English. And then I went from that to trying to tell jokes specifically in Japanese. So I tried to kind of gradually, over the course of 3 or 4 videos, narrow down the audience. But I think that, especially when you're starting out on YouTube, it may benefit you, anyone who's doing YouTube, to maybe initially... Actually, I'm having second thoughts about this as I'm saying it. But obviously, if you're talking about a subject that applies to a whole lot of people, like smartphones, you're naturally going to probably have a larger audience. But at the same time, if you try and appeal to everyone, that often makes your content much less relatable. So I think that one of the reasons that my content is even like viable content for a lot of people is because it actually is so specific. like the strike zone is narrow for my content. You have to know a fair amount about Japanese. You have to, in most cases, have lived in Japan for like a year or so to get most of the jokes. But if you have, then it's funny. So, yeah. You know, just by nature of the content, there's a lot of people that will never understand it. But the more specific you are, the stronger that content will be for that specific audience.
Right. And I guess speaking to your content now, kind of you've been doing it for a good amount of time. I mean, we can even go all the way back to the beginning of YouTube where you had tricking videos, but you've mm-hmm. been on here for quite some time. Mm-hmm. But now you've been doing YouTube and Patreon for quite a while. And I kind of wanted to ask, like, what do you foresee yourself kind of continuing this for maybe the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah. I think that I've had a lot of, what would you say, thoughts about, sorry, my computer just kind of made a weird flickering. The brightness got messed up for a second. But one of the things that I've often thought about is like with my audience, which is, again, small, but it's there. I often think like, what's the best thing that I can do for my audience, and what's like the best thing that I can do as just an individual living in Japan in the world? And I've had different kind of thoughts about that over the years. But the thing that I continue to come back to is that, okay, the Patreon content is good. I think that a lot of people can improve their Japanese through my Patreon series. But I think that, And this sounds like really, really conceited, but I do think that the best thing that I can do, like most other comedians, I'm not really a proper comedian, but is just to do my best to hopefully make someone laugh maybe one more time each day. Because I think, in my opinion, social media is great in many ways, but at the same time, it's kind of also, it brings out the worst in a lot of people in certain circumstances. And online, at least, there's a fair number of people that are kind of like constantly at each other's throats. So I think that in that sense, the best thing that I can do online is just try and not take myself too seriously and just try and continue to tell stupid jokes about Japan and Japanese. And so I think that that's actually my number one strength as well. I think that, again, more than my Japanese ability itself, I think that my creative writing, specifically comedy, which is not the field that I initially wanted to get into, is maybe what I'm best at. So I should probably it'd be the best thing for everyone if I continued to pursue that.
Right. And we're all looking forward to it, us and our listeners included. And I guess now kind of closing out here, we always like to ask our guests about if they have any advice for our listeners in terms of studying Japanese or maybe even looking to go to Japan, work in Japan. And we're wondering what your advice to our listeners would be.
Oh, that's a really interesting question as well. I think that, well, I'll try and answer both of those questions. In terms of advice for studying Japanese, again, I think that if you're listening to this podcast right now, probably there's a high probability that you're studying Japanese by yourself rather than just in the classroom. Maybe you're doing a combination of both. But in that sense, I would kind of like to push the mat versus Japan immersion-based approach one more time. I think that that's the way to go for people that have the self-control and motivation for the long term. And I also think that it's worth mentioning that everyone has their ups and downs when it comes to motivation. And even not, it sounds stupid if I say even I, but I have tons of times where I'm like, I don't want to study today. I don't want to study Japanese today. I don't want to watch Japanese YouTube. I don't want to do this. And I end up doing the lazy thing and I don't do that. And 9 times out of 10, actually just making the conscious decision to take a break rather than trying to power through it, I'll be able to get back into my motivated state at a much faster than if I had tried to power through it. So I think that oftentimes if you are kind of feeling the burn, if you don't have a lot of gas, so to speak, then maybe you're just tired. Maybe you just need to go to bed early that night. Maybe you need to, you know, just take a short break and, you know, do like go out for a run or something like that, rather than trying to like be perfect, so to speak, and not taking a break at all. Taking that break, whether it's for exercise or Japanese studies, in my experience, has been the correct choice in the long run. So that's probably one good piece of advice for certain people. In terms of like living in Japan and coming to Japan, I think I talked about this briefly with Chris Broad not too long ago, but and we talked about this earlier on the podcast, but Japan is changing at a pretty rapid pace. The main reason for that is because, again, of the aging population and all of the changes that come with that. So like the declining economy, the kind of, what would you say, the feeling of constant pressure because of the economy and the fact that like the neighboring country, China, is taking off so quickly right now. I think there's a fair number of people living in Japan, whether they're foreigners or whether they're Japanese people, that are starting to feel a little bit anxious. And anxiety is always, in my experience, a negative emotion that leads to poor choices. And so the number one kind of piece of advice that I have for people that are either already living in Japan or they would like to come to Japan is, rather than trying to do what's good for the short term, and you know, maybe you can make a quick buck like here or there, try and think about your long-term path and whether the step that you're making right now is going to be something that will line up with a happy life for a happy long-term stay in Japan, whether that's until you die, or whether, you know, that's maybe just like 5 or 10 years. But you don't want to make decisions that will kind of be good for the short term and bad for the long term. Like if you play the Gaijin card to get out of a situation easily, oftentimes that's good for the short term because you can get out of that annoying situation. But if you hadn't played the Gaijin card and you had tried to maybe articulate yourself in Japanese, or, you know, look up the kanji that you needed to know at that time on your phone and then try to write it out, those kind of little things will help with the long run. And the next time that you're in that situation, maybe you do know the kanji. And maybe, you know, rather than going out and having like a karaoke party or whatever with your friends, maybe you try and save that money a little bit and reinvest it back into your business. In my opinion, these kind of like small choices for the long term, those are the kind of things that help a lot with not worrying, that help a lot in terms of pushing back that kind of anxiety that I talked about earlier, because that's kind of becoming more noticeable, I think, in everyday life in Japan, whether it's through higher taxes, income taxes, sales tax? Whether it's through sales taxes or the income taxes are slowly going up as well. You know, just those kind of like small choices can really make a big difference in the long term. So that's plan for the long term, I think, is the best advice, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, thank you so much for the helpful advice for all our listeners out there. And I think this is a good point to close out the podcast. Dogen, thank you so much for coming on the Korekara podcast today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for taking out your time today. It's been a long time coming, but it happened today.
Yeah,
I mean, also, definitely, like for those who are studying Japanese, I want to shout out like Dogen's accent course. That's definitely the best resource in English for if you want to learn about pitch accent. So definitely check that out.
Yeah, and thank you very much for the invitation, for having me on, and hopefully you guys continue to have on interesting guests. There's a couple of people, Nick included, that I think that might be good for good choices for the podcast. So I'll try and send those to you after you're done, after we're done. But yeah, thanks again. It was my pleasure. And yeah, thanks for everyone that listened as well. See you guys soon.
Great. And real quick, before we end this out, we do the classic message to the Quote Cutter listeners at the end of our podcast. It's a little special fun thing we like to do. It can be anything, a fun little message, a Japanese proverb, or something that just came to your mind. So Dogen, I'm going to put you on the spot here. All the lights are on you.
It's got to be a Japanese phrase. Dogen's a Japanese teacher.
True. You heard it here from Eric.
Well, maybe one funny thing would be there was a mistake that I made when I was I made a video called Correcting My Friend's Japanese when I talked about Joey the anime man's Japanese and then Chris Broad's Japanese. And right. There was a line in that video where I cited a Japanese proverb, which is nobody's perfect. And the way to say that in Japanese is Saru mo hikara ochiru.
Oh, yeah.
So even monkeys fall from trees. But I actually miscited it in the video. I said, Saru demo hikara ochiru. And so maybe that's a good example of don't take your studies so seriously that you can't even like laugh at yourself. Because I ended up making that a joke in the video, and I switched the English subtitles to nobody's perfection so that it was a mistake in both languages. But maybe that's a good Japanese phrase to anyone out there that's, you know, trying to memorize maybe like one more proverb or whatever. Saru mo kikara ochiru. I think that's the right phrase.
You heard it here from Dogen, guys. And with that, thank you for listening. We'll catch you on the next one. Peace.
Peace.
Sweet. See you guys later. Sayonara.